And welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill, who gets free advertising of the week this week?
Well, I think we ought to go with Hilltop Springs.
Yes, you're reading my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hilltop Springs is a retirement community up on Hilltop Drive, number 7 Hilltop Drive, as a matter of fact. And they're kind of a brand new senior living facility, and they're great.
And they're great. We've walked their halls.
Many times.
They have those terrific little carts. Oh, yeah, thank you. My microphone was, had a mind of its own. It had a mind of its own, and it mostly wanted to float up. Super helpful. I wanted to hold on to it for 2 hours. No, I didn't, actually. So, yeah, Hilltop Springs, they have good food, too, by the way. So if someone invites you over for dinner, you should go. They have really good stuff. And the people are very, very nice.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get right on it.
Do it.
All right. You can find all of our archives and things, because I guarantee you we will replay this show. But the original show is today, September 17th, 2025, and we named it after the book, Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. The author is John Wilson, and he is our guest today. He grew up in Bowles Park Housing Projects in Hartford, Connecticut. I was in West Hartford. We were neighbors with his single mom and 3 half-siblings. Hand-picked tobacco from the ages of 12 to 16 to help his family scrape by. Education and hard work transformed John's life. He earned a bachelor's in chemical engineering and graduated from Harvard Business School with an MBA by the time he was 23. I think he did all right.
He wasn't messing around.
No, he wasn't fiddling around like the rest of us. Spent 5 years in college. He built a successful business career, rising from entry-level positions to leadership roles in multiple Fortune 500 companies, a global executive who has traveled to more than 95 countries, helping to lead companies to their full potential. At 29, he became the youngest partner in Bain & Company's history. As the chief financial officer, he helped Staples become the fastest company to reach Fortune 500. As the COO of Gap Incorporated, he led 80,000 associates to become the first specialty retailer to achieve a $50 billion market value. He also was the president of Staples International and a senior operating partner at McKinsey & Company. Currently lives in Cape Cod, one of my other favorite places, in Massachusetts with his wife Leslie, and they have 3 children. There's some other stuff too, but I won't read all of that. We'll get to that, I'm sure. So our guest is John Wilson, and we are going to let him drive the bus. Yeah. I don't know if they told you that, John, but there would be goofing off and bus driving.
Okay, that sounds fun.
Right? If you're going to spend a little time on a Sunday afternoon chatting about ostensibly what sounds like one of the worst chapters of your life, you know, you might as well have a good time doing it.
There you go.
Where do you want to begin with all of this? What a nightmare.
It has been. It's been a 7-year nightmare for my entire family. Probably the hardest part for my wife and myself has been to see our children suffer, you know, not at the hands of a schoolyard bully who was, you know, making false claims about them and spreading false rumors, but by federal prosecutors who should know better, who did know better, but abused our children to try to make a case against me in the court of public opinion as well as the court of law. And that's just below anything I've ever anticipated from our government.
So if you were going to give people like the elevator speech version of this, I realize that's got to be kind of difficult, but if you were going to do that, can you give them the, you know, 60,000-foot view and then we'll move down?
Sure. If people may recall, the Varsity Blues college admissions scandal happened about almost 7 years ago now, and it involved about 30 parents who were accused of cheating on tests, faking profiles for kids who didn't even play a sport, photoshopping, if you recall some of the famous photoshopping incidents, and bribing college officials to help get their unqualified kids in. And this included a lot of celebrities and well-off families. So Felicity Huffman, Lori Loughlin, those kinds of people. So it was a high-profile case, and the Boston prosecutors first uncovered the case from a random tip from somebody in Connecticut. And they soon pulled on that thread and found there were, you know, Hollywood celebrities involved and a lot of rich and famous people. So they said, aha, this could be a great career builder for us. There was only one problem for those Boston prosecutors. All the people in this case were in California. Rick Singer, who was the mastermind and the con man, confessed con man, behind this whole scandal, also was based in California. His company was in California. Two of the major schools were in California, USC, University of Southern California, and Stanford. And so by all rights, all of those families should have been charged in California. However, that wouldn't have worked for the careers of the Boston prosecutors. They needed some hook to bring all the trials and literally 300 people to fly back and forth between California and Boston. And it turns out that Singer, the mastermind here, had 3,000 parent clients, but only one was based in Massachusetts.
Oh, no.
Me.
Oh, no.
So they needed to charge me to give them venue in Boston. And so despite my facts being completely different from all the other parents, we didn't cheat on any tests. My kids were highly qualified. Our twin daughters got a perfect score in the ACT and a 99 percentile score.
Wow.
And my son was invited to play on the Olympic team, Olympic development program twice in high school. He played for Stanford Club and water polo for 6 years, won the National Junior Olympics 1 year, and played on the USC team. And we made donations to USC, and we got a receipt from the school for our donations. And they kept our money to this day. So we followed all the rules, did everything one would be expected to do. There were some inaccuracies in my son's profile. The Singer had changed my son's swim time by 6%, and his best time. And he had done some things to some awards that I wouldn't even know. Second string All-American versus first string versus third string is sophomore year, junior year, things like that. And that was the fraud, they said, was material. And they railroaded us through a trial that was outrageous. So they basically accused me to give them the venue hook. They falsely accused us. And then they piled on so many charges to try to force me to plead guilty. It was ridiculous. They piled on 9 felonies, 180 years of prison time, and all I did was make donations. I made donations to schools for kids who were highly qualified to give them a tiebreaker boost, and we didn't cheat on anything. We didn't put any false information into anything. Singer tweaked my son's swim times and some other awards, and that was the felony fraud that I was charged with, and it was just outrageous. They were able to do so many things we can talk through one at a time, but, you know, they did things like judge shopping on top of venue shopping. They picked their favorite judge, who happens to be the oldest federal judge in America, 87 years old, makes Joe Biden look young, and basically got that judge to approve all of their motions 98.3% of the time. So they blocked all our evidence. For example, my daughter's perfect ACT test score was not allowed into my trial. So it was inadmissible hearsay. We had certified results from
How can that be hearsay?
And that's what our lawyer said, and the judges said, take it up on appeal.
Were they accusing you of cheating for her?
No, they weren't accused of cheating, but they wouldn't let us bring it in. Oh. My son's certified swim time, the same thing. His high school coach in water polo wasn't allowed to bring in his own swim time because he hadn't witnessed it. It was a swim team swim time. That was the argument, and therefore was hearsay as well.
Oh,
and he was the high school water polo coach. This is the kind of stuff that happens. So they blocked our evidence 98.3% of the time. Didn't happen once or twice. It happened 660 times. So we lost at trial. I would have convicted me, too. We had no evidence of our innocence. They piled on 50 other defense witnesses who were all people who pled guilty. And so they basically said that we were, you know, guilty. And the judge gave jury instructions that said giving money to a school can be considered a bribe to the coach, even though it went to the school. This kind of stuff was going on.
That's not really a thing, though, is it?
No, it's not. And the appeals court said this is absurd. We had a group of law professors write what's called a support brief, an amicus brief, to the appeals court and said this would be the first and only time in history that the alleged victim of a bribe, in this case the universities, is the one who gets the money. How can the victim of the bribe get the money and give you a receipt for the money?
Yeah,
the receipt's awkward.
Yeah, the receipt. It says, I didn't even know you could give a receipt for a bribe. You know, it's crazy. The whole thing is just absurd,
they were new.
But that's the way the judge defined it. The judge defined it. So that's kind of the quick overview. We went to appeal.
Wow.
We also had 11 former U.S. attorneys basically write an amicus brief, another one that said John Wilson didn't get a fair trial. It's almost unheard of for the top U.S. attorneys across the country to criticize their former colleagues, right? Because they did that. And so I didn't get a fair trial because it was so outrageous what they did to me at the trial. And so we got everything overturned at the appeal except for one minor tax thing, which we're still working on trying to get that overturned. It was a tax mistake of $1,425. It's a felony, believe it or not.
Mm.
Even though I deducted the tax, the receipt I had on the wrong line in my tax return.
You must be
the wrong
bad
line.
Person.
And I overpaid my taxes. I overpaid my taxes that year by more than $100,000 because I put my wrong address. I was living in Massachusetts in Europe at the time, working in Europe, and I used my California. I don't read my tax returns. They're prepared by Goldman Sachs and Price Waterhouse. I just signed them through DocuSign. I didn't even read it. And so that was the kind of thing that they can get you for at the end, and we're still trying to appeal that because a $1,425 mistake on my tax return.
But do you get the $100,000 back?
What's that?
Do you get the overpayment back, at least?
I got the overpayment back down the road, after,
nice.
Years later, but, But it's just kind of crazy the kind of stuff they can do to you, right? So that's been the nightmare. And my poor children, the Internet, unfortunately, makes their wounds both deep and permanent. And so having the federal government say my son, they say to this day he's an alleged athlete.
Alleged.
My son had a world record. He had a world record in swimming. He was on the Oprah TV show when he was younger. And he was competing training for 750 hours a year, year-round, on three different club teams. Right? He was a real national and world-caliber athlete who played on the USC team. The whole thing is just absurd.
How old is he now?
Now he's 28. This happened 7 years ago. He was 21 when this happened.
Wow.
He finished his last year. So the whole story here, there's a lot more detail, was just a miscarriage of justice and an abuse of our criminal justice system where they weaponized it. In my case, they weaponized the justice system for personal gain, for career gain. They used me and treated us like collateral damage to get the media spotlights into Boston and to bring all the trials to Boston. And that's what they can do, and they have such power. And when they can cherry-pick their own judge, he approves everything they do. And then you have to go and lose at court and go to the appeal process. And this entire process cost my entire life savings. I grew up in poverty, as you mentioned up front. Literally, we lived on welfare as a kid. So I know the value of a dollar. I worked picking tobacco, as you mentioned, for $1.35 an hour in the sun, 40 hours a week. So I know the value of a dollar. This trial, over 6 years, including the appeal, cost over $11 million. Every penny I've ever saved in my life.
Wow.
Think about that. 11 million. They inundate you with motions and motions and documents. That's the documents in this case. They gave us 5 million documents, pages. Think about that. It cost me $350,000 just to scan all those documents so my lawyers could read them. But they didn't give it to you in a form you could read, right? So they give you 5 million documents because it included 50 people. And they just mix it all up, and they don't have it organized in a way that makes it easy.
Just like you see on TV, where they bring in, the pallets of files and stuff like that to bury them.
Exactly. So they can just bury you in legal fees, they can bury you in motions, and they kept piling on motion after motion. They didn't charge you 9 felonies up front. They charged you with one. And then every 2 or 3 months, they charged you with another one. They say, if you don't plead guilty, we're going to charge you with another one. And they did that and had 9 felonies and 180 years of prison. I finally said to my lawyers, look, they can charge me with killing Kennedy and say I was on the grassy knoll and accuse me of that. I said, I'm not going to plead guilty no matter how many charges. I said, tell them that. And they finally stopped charging me. I said, this is crazy. 180 years of prison time? I said, I'm not going to give up no matter what you say. I'm going to fight. And I've been a fighter my whole life, and I'll fight for my kids to my last breath and my last dollar. And that's really kind of the nutshell of the story. And there's a lot of gruesome and horrific things that they did that were literally beyond my imagination. I've always been a big believer in our criminal justice system in our country. And, my beliefs have been shaken to the core. I still believe most people working in the government are honest, hardworking people. I don't smear everybody. But there can be bad apples, like any large organization. And I unfortunately got some bad actors out of the Boston office who abused the system for their own careers and literally falsely charged me and then tried to railroad me through a process that has been an ongoing nightmare. In addition, we're also suing USC and Netflix.
Oh.
So we're having to fight three Goliaths. Fighting one Goliath, the federal government, is tough enough. But we're fighting three Goliaths because Netflix came out with a movie, they called it a documentary, about me before my trial even happened, and they poisoned the jury pool.
Oh, my gosh.
It's unbelievable, the movie they came out with and how they depicted me in that. So we're suing them, and we actually won.
Well, now after we talk to you, we'll all have to run and go see the documentary, and then we'll really know how bad they are.
Yeah.
John, we have to take a really quick break. I am so glad you are our hostage for both hours today, because there's a lot on this.
There's a lot to unpack here. Yeah.
Just at the outset, I just want to say, I thought it was only people in L.A. I had no idea it had anything to do with anyone on the East Coast or that it was being run out of Boston. So I wonder how many people just didn't ever connect all the dots. Wow. Our guest is John Wilson. He is the author of Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. So we'll be back with him in just 2 minutes. You can find everything about our show and the archive of this if you want to send it to somebody else at
wethepeopleradio.us.
I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
I guess if you ever turn your book into a musical, you can use that one. Oh, we have to turn John's sound back on. How would that be? There we go.
All right, I'm going to let him take over here.
Okay, John, are you in there?
I am here.
There you go.
So, John, your only recourse on this whole thing is just to sue everybody involved?
You can't sue the federal government, unfortunately.
Right.
So that they give themselves immunity, and that's frustrating, believe me, beyond what you can imagine. But we're doing several things. One, I've written a book, my wife and I, to try and get our story out there. And we do want to get the truth out there, and we're working to make sure as many people as possible can see and buy the book. And by the way, for your audience, none of the profits go to us. It's 100% all the proceeds going to charity, including a nonprofit that helps defend people who don't have the resources to fund their own defense.
What happened to us
has never happened to anyone.
Well, okay, so let's play this back to the beginning, and you're just regular guy with a regular job who doesn't have any resources and didn't accomplish all these things, and they come after you. How does that turn out? Are you in jail for 180 years?
Or whatever? Yeah, very much so. So the federal, here's another interesting statistic. The federal government has a success rate, a win rate, conviction rate of 99.6%.
Oops.
Think about that.
Wow.
It's terrifying.
Right? And it's terrifying. And it's not because 99.6% of all the people they charge are guilty. I don't believe that for a moment. But if you fit some purpose, and I believe many people are guilty, don't get me wrong. I don't think everybody's innocent. But, you know, there are some people who are innocent who can't afford to fight, including in our case. In our case, there were 50 people, including some, you know, lower-income people, some coaches, some test takers, some test administrators, some people who didn't have a lot of resources, and they're forced to plead guilty. Who can afford to spend millions of dollars defending yourselves against, you know, an army of lawyers? I think there are 20 government lawyers involved in this, right?
And did all of those people go to jail?
In our case, I think everybody went to jail for either a couple of weeks or a couple of months or 4 months. It was absurd. These people cheated on tests. Yeah, that's wrong. We didn't do any of that, believe me. But is cheating on a test now a federal felony? So that's what they charged me with, cheating on a test. They made it a federal felony. Some people put together fake photos of their kids.
Why? What would a fake photo do?
For the athletic program. So Singer's business model, so he did a lot of legitimate work. So Singer had 3,000 clients, including people like Steve Jobs and John Doerr, very famous people.
To get their kids into college. He was like a consultant guy.
Get their kids into college, right.
Yeah, okay.
He was a college consultant. So Singer was a college consultant who worked with a number of parents, 3,000 parents, and he was helping give them real legitimate services. And for example, in our case, he had tutors. He had a whole fleet of tutors, kids who were in their 20s who went to, top schools, who would help tutor your kids in high school on how to prepare for the ACT or the SAT test, things like that. He had a bunch of legitimate charity work. So we would do some weekend work. I would drive my son from San Francisco, where we lived at the time, to Sacramento to do some charity work, volunteer work, helping tutor inner-city kids in Sacramento. So he had a lot of community service things he did. And he knew everything about most high schools and colleges. I was surprised at how encyclopedic his knowledge was. And my son played water polo for 6 years, and so it's an unusual sport. But we knew all the top schools in the country and all the top teams, because every year we go to the national tournaments for water polo. So we knew all the schools, and he knew them too. So I was surprised. I was impressed. So Singer had this business that he developed over the years, and the way he got his client base was by getting references from highly respected financial institutions, in part. So, for example, Goldman Sachs. He worked with Goldman Sachs, and Goldman Sachs, my representative, who I knew for 10 years, called me up and said, hey, now your son's entering high school when he was a freshman. There's this great resource we have, a guy named Rick Singer, who has worked with a number of our clients and a number of our employees, and, you should take a call. I took a call. When Goldman Sachs recommends someone, you assume they're vetted, and I talked to Singer. I met with him. My family, my son met with him, and he seemed like he knew what he was doing. He didn't know what he was doing. We trusted him. He came from Goldman Sachs, and he knew everything about water polo, knew everything about the colleges, knew everything about high schools. He had real charity work. He had real tutors. So my son was taking like weekly and monthly, tutoring sessions over the internet for an hour or two, helping to practice on, SATs and ACTs, that kind of stuff. So, and we were doing weekend work, tutoring inner city kids. So it was the real deal. We had no reason to distrust him. And when he has people like, Steve Jobs as clients and stuff, you say, he's the real deal. So that's how Singer kind of infiltrated into families. And then he was coming over to your house once a month or so to meet with you and meet with your child. And that's the way he ran his business. He would come to the house, once a month, stop by for an hour, meet with you and our son together. Then he'd meet with my son separately for about 10 minutes. And then he'd meet with us separately at the end to talk about what are the next steps.
And your son's and at what point in school is he? Sophomore, junior?
He was a freshman in high school.
Freshman. Okay.
Right. Wow. He started as a freshman in high school, and we started working with him for years. Well, we worked with Singer for 10 years.
Yeah.
And we had no reason to distrust him. Right? He was doing legitimate things for us, and he had, as I said, thousands of clients. And that was when I was living in California. Then my job took me to Europe. And I moved the whole family to Europe, except for my son. My son was then a junior and senior in high school. He wanted to stay to finish his high school. I don't blame him. And if he went to Europe, my daughters and my wife moved to Europe. At school in Europe, he'd have to repeat a year because they have a different system there, the international baccalaureate system. So he said, I don't want to repeat a year of high school.
Yeah.
And I want to finish. So we let him stay with very close family friends. And Singer said, fine, I'll continue to help tutor him, and I'll help him prepare his college applications. And I was living nine time zones away from California, out in Europe. We were living in Amsterdam for my job. And so it was hard to communicate with nine time zones difference. And so Singer said, I'll make sure his applications are complete. There's nothing missing. I'll make sure that they're all submitted on time. And so we talked by phone and by email occasionally to see how things are going. And so that's how Singer got involved in my son's college application. And I never thought there'd be anything fraudulent, in the materials that he submitted. And,
well, he didn't need to cheat. Right.
He didn't even need to cheat.
So why would somebody do that?
Well, exactly. Why would you even think he's doing that? And he changed the swim time by 6% over his best time. Like, why would you do that? Who cares about 6%? It's like, really? I wouldn't have even known my son's swim time to that level because I didn't pay attention to his swimming. After like his, let's say seventh grade, he shifted over to water polo full time and only did swimming in the swimming season to stay in shape. So, swimming wasn't really his thing. He liked, competing with a team and all that stuff in water polo. So I always went to water polo matches. I didn't go to swim meets very much, maybe once in a while. because swimming wasn't his preferred sport after he got into water polo. So I wouldn't have even known the swim time. I didn't know swim time within 6%. And every year they change so much as he grows, right? He's
sure.
a freshman, he's a sophomore. He grows 3 inches and he gets, 5% faster just because his arm length is longer. So
well, and you had three kids. It's not like you weren't like a stage mom, sitting by the pool.
I'm working, and so I'm busy. I'm working, and I wouldn't know his swim time. Frankly, within 10 or 20%. And so it was the kind of thing that I was shocked that I was even arrested. I got to tell you how this thing started would probably shock your audience too. And it's worth spending a minute or two.
Sure.
So I lived my whole life working hard. I've worked hard. I was successful. I pulled myself up my own bootstraps and was self-made. And I've never been arrested. Never been charged with a crime in my life, right? I follow the rules as best I can and try to earn for my family. And I provided a good life, and I was living the American dream. I was flying from Europe to a client meeting in Houston, Texas, and this is in March of 2019. I get off the airplane, go through immigration and customs. My passport is flagged. There's a problem. They bring me to the back room. In the back room, two FBI agents push me against the wall, tell me I'm under arrest. For honest services fraud. They handcuffed me.
For what?
For honest services fraud, they say.
Okay.
I said, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And you'll be shocked by their answer. I said, we don't know. We've never heard of it before.
Okay.
I said,
oh my
how
gosh.
Can you be arrested for something? You don't even know what it is. You've never heard. Yeah, it's a really unusual charge. It's some kind of fraud is all we know, but that's all we know. I said, what? How can you be arrested for something you don't know? You can't even tell me what I'm under arrest for. Right? It gets much worse. So they proceed then to handcuff me, put me in the car, drive me from the airport. I'm being perp walked, and then go to their facility where they have a booking station. And they do all the normal intake stuff of fingerprints. They give me my call. My wife was in Europe, so I didn't call her. It was too late. And so I called my secretary because I'm in Texas now versus European time zone. And so call her, make my call, please call my wife tomorrow, or my brother, who was a civil attorney, and so forth. And once they figure out how to book me, then they transport me to a federal prison. So they bring me to a federal prison, not a jail, an 850-person prison in Houston. They drop me off and hand me off to these prison guards. The prison guards then shackle my ankles in addition to my handcuffs, so I'm shuffling through the prison. Then they process me there. They strip me down and put me in this large multi-person shower room, and they get a couple of hoses and start hosing me off, power hosing me off like an animal.
Wow.
I still have no understanding of what I'm under arrest for, right? So now I'm being hosed down and have no idea, naked, and then they finally, after they finish hosing me off, they give me a jumpsuit, a brown jumpsuit or tan colored jumpsuit, and I'm still talking and saying, I have no idea why I'm here, and they don't believe me. And they're kind of like saying, shut up, don't talk, look straight ahead. All these, they're barking out orders at me. And I say, I have no idea why I'm here. And they're just like in disbelief. One guard finally, before he puts me into the cell block, my cell block had about 85 people in it. It's like you see in the movies. Two stories, a big common area in the middle, but lots of prisoners mulling around. And one of the guards must have felt sorry for me because I'm just talking up a storm, which is unusual. I'm saying, can someone tell me why I'm here? And he says, hey, look, watch your back in there, his son. He called me son. Watch your back in there, son. He says, you're the only old white guy in the cell block.
Oh, terrific.
And they're all going to assume you're a pedophile. And they hate pedophiles in here.
Oops.
And some of them may try to stab you with a shiv. So watch your back. I said, what?
What?
Can you lock me in my cell? I said, can you just lock me in my cell so I can, at least avoid being stabbed? He says, no, you can't. Lockdown's not until whatever, 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And I said, well, can I stay in my cell? You can stay in there, but then they're going to think you're a real, P-U-S-S-Y. I said, what?
Yeah,
that's not going to end well for you. They said, if you hide in your cell, it's not going to end well. They're going to know you're like a wimp, and they're going to come after you there in your cell. I said, well, geez, what do I do? So just walk around and don't accept any favors from anyone and just watch your back. So now I spent the next 2 days in this prison cell block. Watching my back, every time someone came near me, you think that someone's going to stab me.
Sure.
And it was the craziest experience. I still had no idea what I was even there for. And I remember
what about the whole phone call and that kind of thing?
I made a phone call to my secretary and just told her to call my brother, right? But that's it. I didn't have any information of what was happening to me. All I could do is make one call out. She had no idea. My wife was in Europe, so she was. It was too late to wake her up. And so I just called my secretary and said, please have my brother. My brother would come the next day. But that whole day and night, I had no other contact with anyone. I had no idea what I was under arrest for. I'm in the cell block, and every time someone comes near me, and people approach me doing all kinds of weird things. They want to get some slippers, some bigger slippers. You want to get some food, just trying to offer me things so I would owe them, right? I said, no, I'm not. No, thank you. I kept walking away.
Yeah.
Thinking, and I never, I'll remember this, too, for the rest of my life. I never felt better when I was finally locked in my cell block. I only had one guy in my cell block with me, my bunk mate. And I was bigger than that guy. So I said, look, I'm taking the bottom bunk. Made him take the top bunk so I couldn't get stabbed from underneath. And so I felt a relief being locked in a prison cell. I remember that. It's like, this is crazy. I feel relieved I'm locked in a prison
cell. Sad it wasn't
because
smaller.
Because the other 80 guys can't stab me from the general population.
What prison is this? Not that it matters, but where is
it? It was in Houston. It was the Houston Federal Detention Center, whatever. I don't know what it's called, but yeah.
Okay.
It was just crazy.
How old are you? How old were you when this happened?
I was 59.
Wow! So you're like a grown-up who's now. Bill's shaking his head here.
This is how they started. It was just day one, and the next day they did even worse stuff. Right? This is how they can intimidate you. So the next day, I get pulled out, and they say you have a visitor here, and so they put me in shackles again and handcuffs, and they shuffle me down some hallway to some meeting room in the prison. Where my brother is there, thank God, and he had another lawyer, he had a criminal lawyer with him from Houston, from Texas, and they're behind this plexiglass wall. I couldn't even meet with them. I could just talk to them through this plexiglass wall or whatever it was. And so I'm handcuffed and shackled, and I'm talking to them through this wall. And I said, what's going on here? And they said, there's something about Rick Singer. I said, what? He said, yeah, there's like 50 people all under arrest for cheating and bribing and faking and all the stuff on, you know, profiles in colleges. I said, I didn't do any of that. What's going on? It must be a case of mistaken identity. That's what I told the FBI at first, too. I said, there's 15,000 John Wilsons in America. There literally are.
Wow.
I said, you must have the wrong John Wilson. And they say, no. What's your address? I live in Massachusetts. Oh, you're the Massachusetts guy. They said, yep, you're the right guy. And so that's how this whole thing started. I went to the judge to have a hearing on bail. And then I'll never forget, the Boston prosecutors were on the phone. They weren't there. They were in Boston. They were going to make their big announcements that day in front of the media with all the other people in Boston. I'm in Houston. They're on the phone, and they tell the judge had some kind of bail bonds person or bail person, whatever they're called, talk to me about, you know, my history of not being arrested before, never being charged, living with having a wife for 30 years and children and a job and those kinds of things. And they said, look, you're not a flight risk. You're not a risk to society. You're not going to go out there, and maybe you're a serial donor, but that's not going to hurt anybody.
Serial donor.
You know, so they said, okay, they recommended being released on a bond. And then the Boston prosecutors on the phone said, no, we object. We want $1 million, all cash, that Ms. Wilson had put up. And the judge said, what? That's absurd. Never heard of that. All cash. Just a bond should be fine. They said, no, we object. Throw him back in prison. We're going to appeal your decision. So they threw me back in prison again while they're appealing her decision. She said, look, I'll let you appeal my decision, but I'm going to only give you until the end of the day to come up with new evidence as to why Mr. Wilson is such a flight risk or risk to society that he has to have $1 million of all cash bail. So then they brought me back into prison with my buddies, and then they took me back out at the end of the day, and they said they had no new evidence. The judge said, well, I didn't think you would. They just threw me back in to be spiteful. And then she said, I'm going to release him on a bond. I signed some kind of bond statement, and I was able to leave, you know, the next day.
Hmm.
But that's how they play. They
and
can
what
play
was,
that role.
What was the bond?
I think the bond ended up being like $100,000 or $200,000. I don't even know what it was. Like $200, but I just had to sign a paper for it.
I bet
it was
these,
like, a cognizant bond.
Like all these, you know, illegal alien guys that have committed all these murders and rapes and stuff like that are all just being, you know, moved through the system and then cut loose. I can't imagine after going through that doesn't just light your hair on fire.
Oh, it's crazy.
If you haven't pulled it all out by now.
How different, how they, you know, they say no one's above the law. They just kept sticking to me at every step in this process. And that was just day one. It gets much worse. My story. The high pressure tactics they can do.
Hold that thought, and we'll go to the next phase of the game. So for all of you who thought you knew what was going on with the varsity blues college thing. College admission scandal. That's what they called it, right? Wasn't that the big headline?
It Operation Varsity Blues.
Oh, my God. This truly is the scandal within the scandal. Our guest is John Wilson. You can find all the information about this and the archive of the interview here later this afternoon at
wethepeopleradio.us.
I can't get these memories out of my mind. And some kind of madness has started to evolve. I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of madness is swallowing me whole. Yeah.
Watch out. You might get what you're after. Cool babies. Strange but not a stranger. I'm an ocean Africa. Burning down the house.
Okay, so they burned down your house, pretty much. Put you in the cell, and so we were, Bill and I were talking in the break. Did they do this to everybody? Did they just, like, snatch them off the street and throw them in prison and scare them like that?
No, I was the only one that had that experience. They did arrest people with some pretty harsh tactics in their homes. They came up to people with guns drawn and things in people's homes, and, you know, it's just kind of crazy intimidation.
But they didn't drag them away and, like, you know, talk to them about shivs and stuff
that? They didn't put me, that was the only one who got put into a federal prison for a couple of days. I think they did that to intimidate me because they knew that I had the best facts. They knew I was innocent, and they wanted me to plead guilty no matter what because that would avoid them, you know, having an embarrassment at trial. And when my facts came to light, you know, if they ever came to light and the judge blocked them, they would be embarrassed and say, wait a minute, why are 300 people flying back and forth between California and Boston for this trial instead of one guy going to California?
Yeah, why didn't they just prosecute the people in California? Like, why did they need somebody where you were?
They wanted the case here for their career.
Okay.
The Boston prosecutors wanted the media spotlight that could boost their careers. And I understand that the temptation there. If you're a prosecutor, you make $100,000 to $150,000 a year as a lawyer, which is, you know, a good salary. But if you get a high-profile case like this, this could make your career, and you can get $1 million job, a partner role, at a major national law firm. And so this kind of, you know, opportunity is a ticket, you know, to the top. And so it's very tempting for them to go after these high-profile cases and do whatever they can to make sure they keep them. And that's what they did. They used me as the kind of the venue hook, and it didn't matter if I was innocent. I was just collateral damage to their career aspirations.
Mm. Dang.
So how many people were scooped up on this thing altogether?
50 total. I think there were 52. Roughly 52.
All right.
I think there were 32 parents and 20 others that included, like, Rick Singer, the center, some of his people that work with Rick Singer. There was a couple guys who took tests. There were these guys he had. I didn't know these people.
Yeah. But
they had some guys who were doing test taking for people who could get any score you wanted. They were that smart. And he had some coaches that he was paying, and he had some other people he was bribing. So he did have a bunch of bad actors, but that was only 1% of his client base. Think about that. He had 3,000 parents. Only 32 were charged. So Singer had what his colleague said in an interview with the USA Today. He had wholesome accounts and dark side accounts. And the wholesome accounts never knew about the dark side. So only 1% of Singer's accounts were doing, I'll call it, dark side activities. They were cheating or bribing or doing things. The other 99% were like me. They were innocent.
Right. And of the of the ones that were charged, were they all convicted?
Everyone but one who actually went to trial with me. He was convicted as well. Only two people went to trial. The others pled guilty. I think the others pled guilty. I don't know their facts, but I saw some of their facts. A lot of them had done bad acts. They were cheating on tests. They're talking on the phone about cheating on tests and things. So they all pled guilty except one. That other person ran through the same crazy, unfair trial as I did. He got convicted and everything. And then upon appeal, got everything reversed, all the core charges as well. So that was the only other person. Mm-hmm. But those people were doing bad acts, right? And again, at its core, this is about, you know, wealth and privilege. You know, people who are wealthy abusing their privilege, right?
Right.
And getting unqualified kids in. And that's wrong. I don't condone that at all. But again, our case was totally different. You know, my son played for the USC team, and he played at the national level. My daughters, as I mentioned, had a perfect and a 99 percentile score. Think about a perfect score in the ACT, just to put it in perspective.
Yeah.
Less than 5,000 kids out of 1.8 million get a perfect score, right? So they were extremely talented. That's above, that's the top quartile for Harvard and Stanford, right?
Mm-hmm.
These were not like sloughs and lackeys. These are kids who are highly qualified, and there's no need to bump a more qualified kid. I think one of the big public narratives here is you had these rich people getting kids who are stupid, supposedly, accepted into college and bumping my poor child who's very gifted and talented. I can see the average person saying that. And so it's unfair that this rich person's bumping my more talented daughter or son. In our case, it's hard to get more perfect than a perfect score or a better score. And so there was no need for us to bump anybody. And what Singer told us all along is that, hey, in these top schools, there's 20 qualified applicants for every spot. So your odds of getting here are only 5%.
Mm.
If you make a donation, you can improve those odds to 50% or 25%. And you can do that, and you can either be, if you're a D1 athlete, you can be a walk-on candidate, or if you're not an athlete, you can be a team manager, and you make a donation to these schools, and they'll give you a team manager role for your kid, and they'll give you a tiebreaker boost. Your kid has to be qualified, and we never cheated on anything. If your kid's qualified and there's 20 spots, it can be a tiebreaker boost if you donate $100,000 or $200,000 or whatever the number is for the school.
Hmm.
So now,
but that's what we did.
Is your son the oldest of the three kids?
Yes, he's the oldest. He was a finished up his last year at USC when this happened.
That's what I was going to
ask. It was just horrific for him. It was just horrific for him. And he graduated eventually, and he got a nice degree in economics. He had a 3.0 in his economics major. So he's clearly qualified, right? And USC doesn't have great inflation, so he did, you know, did well there. And he played on the team his freshman year. And after that, he got his fourth concussion. Water polo can be a brutal sport. People throw elbows and knees a lot.
Sure.
So he got hit in the head again. And so it was his fourth concussion. And they'd have these processing speed and all these other protocols. And so in high school, he had several concussions. And, you know, he said, why am I going to keep doing this? I don't risk my brain. My brain's too important, he said. And so he resigned after this. He went through the entire season and postseason and trained with the team and everything else. But after the season was over, he said, look, I'm not going to keep doing this. I want to risk my brain. My brain's my future. So fine. But that was it. And that's all. You quit after the first season.
He was good enough to be on the team, qualified to be on the team. So why would...
He was one of the fastest on the team. He was literally one of the fastest on the team. So the irony here is they said, oh, you exaggerated the swim time. Singer did exaggerate the swim time, but his actual certified swim time was still one of the fastest on the team. The judge wouldn't let us bring that into the trial, which is crazy. But he was one of the fastest, and his high school coach recommended him to the team. My son played for one of the top 20 high school coaches in the country. This guy, Jack Bowen, he has more wins than anybody. He has 500 wins in water polo, coaching high school. He has coached, I think, something like 55 kids who've gone to play in D1 and other colleges over his 20-year career. He was a twice NCAA MVP water polo player when he played for, I think, Stanford. And he was an Olympic team goalie. So this guy was the real deal, his coach. His coach trained my son through middle school and high school and called USC to recommend my son. And he testified at my trial that he recommended my son to the school. And the government said, it doesn't matter if your son's the best at the trial. He said, if he's the Tom Brady of water polo, if there's one false statement in this, you know, one-page profile, that's fraud.
Oh, my God.
My son's swim time by 6%, really? That's it? But no one could even know how much was off because the judge wouldn't let us bring in the real swim time.
So when
best times, right?
So this all started, so the consultant was hired when your son was a freshman, and
right.
Then he gets accepted, obviously, goes to USC,
plays on the team.
After his senior year, everybody's going along fat, dumb, and happy, like just living their lives. And then when does all this, when do you suddenly become acquainted with Bubba in the cell?
2015, 14. Right, and then all of a sudden it's 2019. So what happened in 2019, we're talking to Singer about my daughters. My daughters just starting to enter high school. They were freshmen in 2019, and so Singer's talking to us about helping them with coaching and tutoring. And so my daughters are, you know, doing extremely well. They're getting, like, perfect scores on some of their tutoring. So Singer's talking to me on the phone about, you know, making donations again. He called it the side door. Singer said there are three ways to get into colleges. There's the front door, which everybody uses. There's something called the back door. These are not, like, nefarious. He said they're all, and there's literally emails from Singer saying this, that the front door, back door, and side door are all legitimate. It just depends on how much money you donate and what benefit you get. If you donate, you know, millions of dollars to fund a building or something, or naming rights for a building, you get what he called lifetime VIP status. You become a big name to the campus, and you can help get your entire family for generations sometimes into the school. You know, you donate a building, and all of a sudden now there's, you know, pull within the university to get your grandchildren in and your nieces and nephews in if you want.
And that's all legal.
Called the back door. It's all legal, the back door.
Yeah.
He said the side door is just a one-time VIP. You make a smaller donation, $100,000 up to $1 million, depending on the school, and you get one child only, a special boost for one child. And it's usually with the sports team, he said. You can do it with other programs, but sports teams, and they'll have walk-on spots if your child's a really good athlete, or they can be a team manager if they're not an athlete on those teams. But you make a donation of $100,000 or $250,000, something like that, and you get a one-time VIP status. That's how I described it, the back door, side door, and front. So I said, okay, great. I had already donated, you know, I don't say this in my book, I say it, but I don't say this to brag, but I'd already donated a couple $1 million over my lifetime. I've been very successful. I believe in giving back. I even funded all of my nieces and nephews' college, right? So I did this in 1998, I put $100,000 to fund my five nieces and nephews into a trust of my brother. It was not allowed into my trial, but we had it. And that was enough to pay for all five of their college. Back then, $20,000 could pay for college, believe it or not, you know, 28 years ago or something.
It's okay. We're old. We remember that.
Yeah, but I was basically, yeah. I believed in college. College changed my life. I went from picking tobacco to being a professional at, you know, Exxon and then moving on to an MBA. And so I believed in the power of education.
Sure.
I'd always given. And in my will, and this is something they also blocked for my trial. They wouldn't let my written will in. In my will, I was giving $5 million to Harvard, where we were applying with my daughters, and to RPI, where I went to school, right? And in that will, it said explicitly that would be all for scholarships for kids whose parents didn't go to college, like mine. I had a single mom who had an eighth-grade education, and my dad, who adopted me, my stepdad later on, he had a 12th-grade education. That's it. He was a sergeant in the Air Force. So I know the power of education. And I was leaving millions of dollars. I was highly successful. I was leaving millions of dollars in my will to fund this. Singer knew that, and the government knew that. And so they tried to take advantage of me. They said, look, why don't you donate a piece of that now? And this is in 2019 when they're recording these calls. Give a piece of that to Harvard and Stanford, and you're just going to move up what's already in your will, and it'll help your daughter's admissions chances. I said, okay, fine. So I gave them each $500,000 through Singer's Foundation in 2019. It went to his foundation, which I also verified with Goldman Sachs, with the IRS, was in good standing. And the IRS website said, you can rely on this confirmation that your donations can be tax deductible. Then they tell me, so here's one side of the government, the IRS, with their official website for Singer's Foundation called the Key Worldwide Foundation, is verifying and certifying that it's in good standing and you can deduct your donation. And then when I made it, they said, we can't deduct that. That's all a tax fraud. So wait a minute, trust the IRS website. Wow. So this is kind of something they can do. So they set me up, and with all these other parents, just in these recorded phone calls, how they can separate things and make you sound bad, is they had people talking about cheating on tests. They had parents literally using the word bribe and bribing coaches, bringing cash to coaches and so forth. The only thing that Singer said to me that was incriminating a couple of weeks were, are you okay if I give a check to the sailing coach at Stanford? I say, sure. You know, to me, it was a check, just like we gave a check to USC. You gave a check, it was made out to the school. You have to give the check to somebody. You don't just throw the check in the pool. You give the check to somebody. You give it to the person who's the coach, and he gives it to the foundation at school. And it was made out to the USC Foundation, for example. It was made out to USC water polo. It was one water polo. It was the USC Athletic Fund, the Trojan Athletic Fund. It was called. So man, it's a Trojan. So you give a check to them. So on the phone calls, he says, "Are you okay if I give a check to the coach?" I say, "Sure." And then when the jury hears 30 other parents talking about bribing, 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 and then you hear my phone call and he says, "Are you okay giving a check to the coach?" Well, it sounds like my check to the coach is a bribe. But it wasn't. My case is totally different than their cases, right? And so that's how they can blur things and make you sound guilty. But I never said I'm going to bribe someone. I just said I'm
going
to check
the coach. John, hang on. We've got a lot more to cover here, but we have to take a little break for the news.
Sure.
So we'll put a little Johnny Cash in here for you. You're listening to We the People.
.us.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antonio.